Here's something to chew on. 60 million people in the United States now rely on a government $150 trillion in debt for their food. This leads us to ask, who will feed the 60 million? Should government go belly up?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 954th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio, GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Valparaiso who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with the engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron, I have a question for you.
I may have an answer.
Okay, good. Who do you think will feed the 60 million should government run out of money?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to work on that today. Folks, when asked the meaning of Naked Lunch, a title he suggested for a Williamsburg novel, Jack Kerouac said, "Naked lunch means exactly what the words say, a frozen moment when everyone sees what's on the end of the fork." Here's some Naked Lunch. According to the USDA, which is the Department of Agriculture, 1 in 5 citizens of the United States now receive food stamps from the federal government. What we can all see at the end of this fork is the fact that 60 million people now rely on a government $150 trillion in debt for their food. Now here's some more Naked Lunch. The number of people on food stamps has nearly doubled in the past 5 years. The size of the federal budget's federal deficit, which is to say the ongoing deficit, has increased by 70% in the past 5 years. And here's the really tough one. 92 million working-aged Americans have fallen out of the work force, gone. What we can all see at the end of this fork, of course, is a trend that simply is not sustainable, and that sooner or later, something must give. And so today we pause to ask, who will feed the 60 million should government be the thing that gives way and can no longer afford to pay for all of those people to eat? Well, will it be industry? Will it be local food banks? How about community churches and synagogues? Next door neighbors? All of the above? Or none of the above? Here to help us explore the question of government food, we have Rachel Sheffield. Rachel is the a policy analyst at the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. Rachel, welcome to the Food Chain. So happy to have you aboard today.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, you're an authority on marriage and the family at the DeVos Center for family and civil society. I love the notion of a civil society, but what exactly do you mean by that?
It's a good question. I think when we talk about civil society, we're meaning those organizations like the family, communities, churches. These organizations that help society run.
I always thought of them as the glue that holds us all together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good way to describe it. Yeah, absolutely.
And then that's part of the Heritage Foundation. What is the Heritage Foundation?
The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we provide policy recommendations, specifically on federal issues, but occasionally on state policy issues as well.
Fair enough. We always ask, Rachel, who pays the way? Who pays the way for the Heritage Foundation?
Well, it's mostly private donors, so we have a broad donor base.
Okay, fair to say that they're a broad base of Republican, or not necessarily Republican, but at least probably conservative donors then.
Yes, most likely.
Okay, fair enough. Always like to ask because it gives the audience a chance to know where we're coming from today and who's talking.
Right.
And then it lets us be free to talk because people know where we're coming from. So, Rachel, it seems to me, that the good book teaches us that we should feed the hungry. But instead of us feeding the hungry, it seems like we've kind of foisted the job off on government and said to the government, here, you feed the hungry. I'm tired of it. I don't want to do it. So you do it. And so government kind of has taken over that job and industrialized it to the extent that now a huge percentage, 20% of the population, is being fed by the government. What the heck happened?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, if we look back, we go way back into American history, kind of look at the welfare system. I mean, prior to, really the 1960s, most charitable endeavors were based in civil society.
By civil society, you mean those institutions that held us all together, like the family, the church, and so on.
Right, exactly. And, there were other, charitable organizations around the country that sprang up. In the 1960s, it kind of became the notion that somehow we could sort of spend our way out of poverty. And so we saw the Great Society under a Lyndon B. Johnson form. And we're actually, it's actually the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty just last month. So that's something we've been talking a lot about as well. But, there was kind of this notion that the government could fix poverty by spending enough money on it, and that's been the notion for the last five decades. And as we've continued to pour more and more money into this system, it continues to grow. Today we have over 80 federally funded welfare programs that provide not only food but cash, housing, medical care, social services, etc.
Cell phones, too. Everything.
Yes.
Pretty much everything. Well, was it the war on poverty that where we made that transition from, civil society taking care of those in need to government taking charge?
Well, I think it was kind of the biggest push by government to, to delve into the anti-poverty realm. And, it's not to say that there aren't, that civil society doesn't function still in America. There are still multiple endeavors across the country, churches, charitable organizations that do provide. But, I think certainly the federal government that it is a harm and that there is kind of this disconnect of, if we're the federal government, the government should take care of this. And, that there's certainly a threat to, that idea that we need to be helping our neighbors.
If government's helping our neighbor, why should we bother? I mean, that frees us to go about the job of enriching ourselves and not having to worry about our neighbor in need. We could just, the government's taking care of you, so don't bug me.
Right. And, in the United States today, if we look at our welfare system, we ask the question, okay, well, has it worked? We've spent $20 trillion on this war on poverty, over the last five decades, which is more than the federal government has spent on all military wars combined. And has this war on poverty worked? Well, you can look at that in two ways and say, okay, yes, this money in some ways has contributed to kind of artificially boosting the material living standards of the poor. As far as really addressing the causes of poverty, as far as really promoting self-sufficiency, it's failed to do that. I think that we've failed the poor, and our welfare system, the policies need to be reformed in a way that it doesn't stand in the way of the civil society, that it promotes the well-being of the individual rather than just pours money at the symptoms of poverty.
So instead of fixing poverty, we kind of find ourselves where we're actually subsidizing poverty, and those in poverty are still in poverty, But now at least they have flat-screen TVs to be in poverty with.
Right. We've addressed, you know, we've addressed the issue of material poverty. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't people that are still struggling or that do live, you know, in very, very meager conditions. But, you know, we have, I mean, if you do look at the statistics, if you look at government data on the poor.
Hold those statistics for a minute because we're going to get to them after we get back from this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Rachel Sheffield, policy analyst at the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. And you, questions we're looking at today, to what extent have we come to rely on government for our food? What happens to the family unit when government becomes its principal breadwinner? And who will feed the hungry should government, and government is in debt? What happens if it goes belly up? Who will feed the hungry? Right back. Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. Here's some Naked Lunch for you. 1/5 of America, 20% of everybody in this country, is now on food stamps, according to the United States Department of Agriculture. That means essentially that 60 million people are now reliant on a government that's $150 trillion in debt for their food. Why do I say $150 trillion? Well, there's $17 trillion of current accounts that are in deficit. That means our yearly budget, right? There's $17 trillion behind there. But another $135 to $150 trillion in IOUs we have under the pillowcase and that we're not looking at. That's for things like Medicare and Social Security and all of those guarantees that the government has made us and has absolutely no way of funding. So there you are. Tough numbers. Naked Lunch. How did we get there? Where are we going to go? That's the question. We're working with Rachel Sheffield. She's the policy analyst in the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. You were talking about some tough numbers there, Rachel.
Yeah, well, just kind of I'm talking about what poverty looks like in the United States. And, you know, doing in some of our research, we've looked at this, looking at government data. And, you know, poverty in the United States, if we look at the numbers, it's very different than what most people think of when they think of poverty. So, for example, you know, 80% of poor households in the United States have air conditioning. Nearly 3/4 of them on a car or a truck. Nearly 2/3 have cable or satellite TV. 2/3 have at least one DVD player. Half have a personal computer. You know, more than half of poor families with children have a video game system. So, you know, we're talking about a very different picture of poverty than kind of what most people imagine when they think of poverty. You know, and again, this isn't to say that there aren't those individuals who are, you know, living in very, you know, very hard conditions in the United States. But, you know, but on average, you know, most poor households are, you know, they're struggling to get by, but they're not living in kind of this destitution that sometimes the media or sometimes the left will try and portray.
So it's kind of like poverty with a flat screen TV.
Right. And, you know,
which is kind of an interesting notion because, you know, when you think about poverty around the world, you think about, you know, destitution, you know, people who are struggling to find the next bite of food to eat. But not so much here anymore. How did poverty get so rich? If you
well, Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of it is because we do have a welfare system. We spend nearly $1 trillion a year on programs for low-income people in the United States. So, I mean,
that's a trillion?
Nearly a trillion a year, yep, on 80 different welfare programs. So it's a huge amount of money that's going into these welfare programs, and that certainly plays into it. I mean, there's other factors. You know, you talk about just how, you know, because of, you know, items like this become more commonplace as time passes. You know, that drives down the prices, so it's more affordable for more households. But, and you know, as a country too, we've just become more, we've become richer. I mean, if we just look at, you mm-hmm. know, total household, you know, what that total, like, amenities for households over time, it's become, you know, all household, has risen. All households,
The old rising tide lifts all boats.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And
so there's that factor as well.
Well, that's quite a stunning number when you think about it. But I was thinking about the numbers, and you see the trend in numbers to become quite frightening, actually, where you have the number of people on welfare increasing by 70. What is it? Almost 100%. It's almost doubled in the number of people on food stamps is almost doubled in the last 5 years. The federal budget deficit has increased by 70%, and that's just the current account deficit. And 93 million people, that's almost one third of the population, has dropped out of the labor force. And now we're told that food stamps, the principal recipient of food stamps, are working-aged adults.
Yeah, and it's interesting because certainly the weak economy has played into that, but there are policies that have also made it easier for people to get on the food stamp rolls and to stay there. And that has also contributed to the growth in food stamp use.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the modest work requirement in food stamps that was there has been waived by the majority of states. The federal government, the Obama administration, has basically allowed states to waive that small work requirement. And so, you know, able-bodied adults are, you know, if their income is low enough, they're able to get on food stamps without, you know, having any type of work requirement or having to look for work or do anything like that. So
all you have to do is go down and ask for them, essentially, and you get food stamps.
Essentially, yes. So, you know, Americans are generous people and they want to help their neighbors, but at the same time, they expect their neighbors to do what they can to help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so a work requirement, you know, it serves as a gatekeeper. So, you know, help is available if individuals need it, but at the same time, if an individual could go elsewhere or could try to get a job or move towards work, you know, it also encourages mm-hmm. individuals that way.
But you're right. We are a very generous people, and we want to see we believe that what the good book tells us, that we want to feed the hungry. But in giving that responsibility over to the government, do we lose that other half of that equation where we expect some kind of responsibility? I mean, who cares whether they're responsible or not, as long as I don't have to take care of them, as long as the government's giving them everything they need, you know, I don't have to worry about whether they're responsible or not. And so that nobody's worried about responsibility anymore, or are they?
Well, you know, I think if we look at our policies and we look at all our welfare programs, there's 80 of them, policy doesn't reflect that idea of encouraging individuals towards work. I mean, there's very few programs that have any type of work requirement. And so our policies should be encouraging able-bodied adults to work. We should be addressing that issue. I mean, if we look at the data, even in good economic times, work rates among able-bodied adults on food stamps are low. And so, you know, it's not simply a matter of the economy, but it is a matter of, you know, there's something going on, and there needs to be, you know, encouragement so that people are mm-hmm.
Well, let me approach this from the other direction. Why should they be responsible if you're just going to give them everything they need? And with no questions asked. I mean, why be responsible when being not responsible pays so handsomely?
Right, and I mean, I think for anybody, having some type of encouragement is important. I mean, it's definitely easy if nothing is required. I mean, then there wouldn't, you know, it does make it a lot easier to just to not do, you know, do those things that will help you, you know, be motivated to get work. And I mean, that's not to say that individuals on food stamps don't want to be working, but you know, certainly there are some that may need more of that encouragement, and we should ensure that our policies reflect that.
This one, we're going to have to take a quick break in a minute here, but when we get back, when I got out of the Navy and was going to school and living on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, the government offered me some surplus food, which was like a chunk of cheese and some macaroni and stuff like that, and for which I was most grateful. And for which I was very grateful to get rid of and be able to buy some real food. But that temporariness seems to have disappeared from the system. And that's kind of what I want to pick up when we get back with a question. What happens to the family unit when government becomes its principal breadwinner? And who better to ask than Rachel Sheffield, the policy analyst for the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. And that civil society means the family, the church, those institutions that traditionally held us together but are eroding rapidly in the face of, what, modern times? Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain. Well, like many, I once participated in a government food program. It was just out of the Navy, going to school, living on the GI Bill, paying rent, not much money, living on peanut butter and jelly, and the government offered me some surplus food, and I took it and was grateful for it. But it was a very, very temporary kind of thing, and they always looked at you and said, why are you, young man, on this government food program? And I just told them, you know, and they looked at me, and okay. But it doesn't seem to be that way anymore. As I was just told by engineer Aaron Shore, who works in a grocery store, the government food aid now comes in an EBT card, which is like a credit card. And inside that card is food and sometimes cash and who knows what else. And so I got to wonder what on earth happens to the family unit, the family structure, the civil society that we used to enjoy when government steps in and starts handing out these cards that have all of these goodies in them. And that's what we're going to ask Rachel Sheffield. She's the policy analyst in the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. What happens, Rachel, when government becomes the breadwinner?
Well, you know, if we look back at the 1960s and we look at where we are today as far as the family unit goes, we've unfortunately seen a major decline in the family. We see, you know, for example, back in the 1960s, about 6% of children born to single parents. And today that number has increased to over 40% of all children. So, you know, it's a huge increase in unwed childbearing. You know, we see marriage decline, you know, simultaneously with that. And, you know, this is tragic because, you know, children born to single mothers are more than five times as likely to be poor as those born to married parents.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Five times?
Yeah, right. Over five times as likely to be poor. It's a huge disparity there.
So yeah, that's kind of like a self-sustaining whirlpool in which people get caught up and away they go. Because once it seems like it's almost becomes a generational problem then, doesn't it?
It certainly can, because, you know, children that are born to single parents, it's not only that they're more likely to be poor, but they're also less likely to thrive down the road. You know, they're at greater risk for dropping out of school, greater risk for participating in delinquent behaviors, greater risk for becoming single parents themselves. So, it's a major problem mm-hmm. and something that we really need to address as a society.
So, once upon a time, the man was looked upon as the breadwinner in the traditional family unit, and of course. I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there today who are throwing bricks at the radio for me talking about the traditional family unit, but there once was such a thing, and the man was typically or traditionally the breadwinner in that unit. What happened to the man when government became the chief breadwinner?
Well, what we see in low-income communities all too often is that the father isn't involved in the picture. He's not, we see broken families. And, certainly our welfare system has made it possible for women to have children without a father being present. We need to reconnect men with their families. We need to work on improving in marriages, because I think it's not to condemn these individuals, but I think the reality is that they do want healthy families, they do want strong marriages, but they've broken down. And
how do you reconnect a man with his family when essentially you have rendered him useless?
Yeah, and that's a very big. Good question, and I don't think there is any simple solutions. But I think we first of all really need to start talking about this issue, because it's just when we hear discussions of poverty, of how to fight poverty, it's not brought up. It's almost like there's this social silence. We don't want to talk about it, and so I think first talking about it would be a good step. We see there are communities around the country that have programs to promote healthy marriage, to provide education to individuals and couples that want to sustain and or create and or maintain their relationship, but we need to see much, much more of that. And there's a long way to go, and we need to start somewhere.
But it seems to me, and of course I might probably be wrong, I don't know. Folks, you're invited to call me up and tell me I'm crazy. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, Michael Olson, Food Chain Radio with Rachel Sheffield, and you. How can we pull the family back together and the other institutions of civil society, the churches and whatnot, when it seems like we've been doing everything we possibly can to dissolve those glues in society, to render the family insignificant, I guess, almost, to render the man in the family most certainly useless? What good is a man anyway? And who needs church? And who needs all of those things when government takes care of us all? How do you start putting the glue back together, Rachel?
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's a major question that we need to face, and I think that we need leaders at every level of society. So we need civil society. We need, even at the federal level, talking about the importance of marriage, addressing these issues in their communities, building relationships with individuals who are in need of assistance, who are in need of, and help in healing their family relationships.
Mm-hmm. But if you talk about it and you hold up the importance of the family, and yet you supplant the principal characters of the family with government, then you can talk all you want, and it really isn't going to have any impact, because those things that held the family together are gone. The role of the husband and wife, the importance of the family's faith, and all of those things. You're doing your best to get rid of them, And then, you know, if you stand up and say, gee, it's really important that we have families, it's kind of like, why waste the air?
Yeah, and I think that there's a couple of things. I mean, we do need to reform our welfare system so that we're getting rid of things like marriage penalties. So first of all, not doing harm in that way. And I think also things like work requirements are important. You know, they may not necessarily address the issue of marriage per se, but it's encouraging personal responsibility.
Well, in terms of personal responsibility, we're going to come to the big question of the day, which is the one that's really got me stumped. And that is, what happens to all of the hungry people and the people who have come to rely on the government if the government simply goes belly up? And ladies and gentlemen, the government is so far in debt, $150 trillion. Holy smokes. What happens if the government can no longer print the money to pay for the food in the plastic cards? That's the question we're going to pick up with Rachel Sheffield and you, 800-624-2665, 831-4790-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back with you. Ladies and gentlemen, here's some naked lunch. Our federal government is spending $17 trillion more than it takes in. $17 trillion, but wait, there's a lot more. It has promised to spend another $135 to $150 trillion, more than it even has any way of paying its unfunded liabilities. It's promised to pay for Medicare and Social Security and all of those wonderful government programs that it comes up with. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 to $180 trillion in the whole, our federal government. And here's something that's especially problematic. The number of people working to pay off that debt is falling, going down and down and down. 92 million people have fallen out of the workforce here in the United States of America. Fewer and fewer people paying for a more ever-increasing debt. The item at the end of the fork that we can all see is that the numbers are not sustainable. And sooner or later, something is going to have to give. And what if that's the federal government? What if the federal government fails to pay for all of the food that it now provides people? 60 million people rely on the federal government. What happens should the federal government go belly up? Well, that's not a very good prospect to ponder, but I think it's a prospect that we should ponder because those are the numbers, unless somebody can convince me that I'm wrong. Am I wrong, Rachel Sheffield?
Well, certainly our government is in major trouble. I don't think anyone would argue with that at all.
Fair enough.
I agree with you.
Let's see what Paul has to say. Folks, the phone numbers today are 800-624-2665, 831-4790. Michael Olson with Rachel Sheffield and you. And here's Paul. Paul, welcome to The Food Chain.
Good morning, and what a beautiful morning we're having here on the Monterey Bay this morning. It's absolutely gorgeous out here.
Yep, paradise.
Well, you know, I think it's really kind of interesting because, you know, this is a great experiment that America has always dealt with. And, you know, if we go back into history, there used to be these things called the poorhouses. There used to be this thing called the workhouses where, yeah, the government would help you out, but it came at a cost. You had to be productive. It wasn't just a free handout. You had to do something. You know, you got something, but you had to do something. You know, when I was a kid, hobos, even though they would ask you for a donation, they were willing to work. They were willing to clean the yard. They were willing to go and do something. And what, you know, I look at that philosophy, and I kind of looked at it and said, well, what is different than today? Well, when you're hungry, you're willing to do anything you can for a meal. You're willing to use whatever services you can provide someone else to be able to feed yourself or have a nice warm place to lay down at night. Now our government has gone the complete opposite. They want the collective, but they don't want the person to feel like have bad feelings about themselves. Well, that's what our problem is. In the old days, you had food stamps. When they went to the grocery store, there was a little humiliation a little bit about having to be on the dole because they were using a currency that wasn't normal American currency. Now with the EBT cards, oh, it's just a debit card. Well, no, it's not a debit card. It's a debit card that we have to borrow money to be able to provide to somebody else.
Yeah, that's kind of it, what we were talking about earlier with respect to, you know, removing the onus of all of this. But let me ask you, Paul, because this is a question I'm really concerned about, is who's gonna feed all the 60 million people if government goes belly up?
Well, and there again, you know, you go to other countries. I have a friend of mine who's from Brazil. Hungry is hunger, okay? You know, you look at some of the people that are on the welfare, and they've got high-definition TVs. They've got microwaves. They've got all these amenities that in other countries, my goodness, they wish that even if they were working as hard as they were for, you know, making a substantial income, still don't have.
Yes, but Paul, who's going to feed them if there's no longer anybody to pay for all that stuff and the food? Who's going to, if we get rid of civil society, if we get rid of the family, if we get rid of the church, if we get rid of the Red Cross and all of those wonderful nonprofit organizations, the food banks, who's going to feed all those people?
Well, and that's the whole point is, you know, you have to learn how to fend for yourself. You have to be willing to go ahead and trade your services or work for something to try and get, you know, it's a commodity, you know, and the problem is that what are we, you know, we pay all this, these millions of dollars in welfare, and what do we get back as a society? What do we get back for it? Mm-hmm. More people with more people putting their hand out.
Paul, let me ask you this. Are you going to feed those 60 million people if the government fails?
No, but I'll feed my neighbor, and I'll feed my neighbor's kids if they help me with what I need to get done. And that's the whole point, is that's the generosity of the American public.
Good enough. Thank you for that call, Paul. Rachel, what do you think? Nobody wants to answer that question because it's an impossible question to answer, isn't it?
It is an impossible question to answer. I mean, I guess I would just say, you know, before we get there, that's why we need to reform our welfare system with things like work requirements.
Who wants to reform our welfare system? I think, you know, most of us have foisted the responsibility of taking care of our neighbors who need help off to the government. Here, government, you take care of it. And I don't want to think about it. And so we have this wonderful freedom now not to think about those in need, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting if we look at polling data, for example, because the vast majority of Americans agree that there should be a work requirement for welfare. And so people do seem to understand this concept, you know, whether or not they... And so I think that there is support for that type of policy. And you know, if we look back in 1996, for example, there was a welfare reform. It reformed the largest cash assistance program in the country.
But somehow we got right back into the muck. So I'm going to have to take the last break. But when we come back, the big question, who is going to feed the hungry? Should the government run out of money? Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am a member of the Lions Club. The Lions Club became the world's largest service organization by helping the visually impaired see. Wonderful service, if you think about it. When you help people see, you've done good, no matter how you look at it. Then government stepped in and said, we'll help people see, and we'll help give everybody glasses. And so the government did step in. And what happened then was that the Lions Club had no service to perform in the traditional sense. And so the Lions Club kind of got lost, like most service organizations. But that's not the biggest part. I'm thinking of things like the American Family. When government stepped in and started being the breadwinner for the American Family, well, who needs the man? Who needs the Lions Club? Who needs any part of civil society if government is going to do everything? A government that is $150 trillion in debt. Roxanne, what do you think?
Hi.
Hi.
Now, I go to a small food bank here, and long before they were even talking about all the cuts they were going to make to food stamps, changed its name to SNAP, and told us, came in and said, wouldn't you like to get $200 a month free groceries? Then they came and took applications, and people more or less didn't really make it. You know, they didn't fulfill whatever the obligations were. And they said things like, well, you're getting that in your Social Security. You're getting food stamps in your Social Security, which I don't know what they were talking about, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, and we're almost out of time, hon, so hurry up.
Well, I just want to say that I think it was all a ruse.
That's a ruse.
First say they were taking food stamps away.
Well, let me ask, well, thank you very much for that interesting comment. Let me ask Rachel Sheffield. Rachel, it seems like a ruse. It seems like it's something that we have done to ourselves and kind of rendered all of those elements of civil society almost useless. Am I wrong?
Well, our government has definitely come and they are trying to take the place of us.
We're out of time, Rachel Sheffield. Thank you so much for joining us. Rachel Sheffield from the Heritage Foundation. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.